Welcome to the Mentors Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a new series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Our guest today is Nicole Gregory, author of Defying Danger, a novel based on the life of Father Matteo Ricci, an Italian Jesuit priest, the first European to enter the forbidden city of Beijing in 1601, and the gentleman who translated the Confucian classics into Latin for the very first time. Welcome, Nicole.
Hi, Roseanne.
So fun to talk about all these cool people we've been meeting along the way. Of course, I always start with asking, why does Father Matteo matter to us today?
Well, I think he was pretty courageous. He was a missionary, and we don't know many missionaries in our modern life, but he was really committed to bringing the best of Christianity to people he thought really needed it. And that was China. That was all of Asia, as a matter of fact. He couldn't wait to get there. He imagined, he had dreams of converting all of India and all of China when he was a young man.
That's a pretty big dream. So I'm going to have to ask, because that's the topic of conversation these days, how was he received when he arrived?
Well, he had a journey. He didn't just arrive. It was a long and complicated journey. He left Rome and went to Lisbon, where he had to stay for about 6 months because there were storms that prevented him from sailing. He went from Lisbon to Goa in India, and he had to stay there for several years. He became ill, and also he worked at the Jesuit residences there in the schools. And then he took a long journey from there to China, to a place called Macau. And actually, I should backtrack a little bit and just say Goa was a Portuguese enclave, and so was Macau. Macau today is like the Las Vegas of China, of southern China. But back then, it was a Portuguese seaport, and there was a lot of trading, and that was his first entree into China. So it was called China, but it was actually more Portuguese in nature. Then from there, he made some friends there. From there, he ventured into the land of China, which was very dangerous, actually, for him.
Interesting. Because?
Because they had never seen a European before. And at the very sight of a European man, people would either run or run up to him and try to grab him or say things to him. They did not trust his motives because in the past, foreigners had come to China to plunder, to, you know, kill people, or to try to change them from their beliefs into another culture altogether. So he encountered a lot of danger.
Interesting. How did he deal with that? How did he get people to trust him?
So this is the really interesting thing about Father Ricci, is that he had a way of being a missionary, which was taught to him by his superior named Alessandro Valignano, which was to lead with kindness rather than trying to dominate the people he was wishing to convert. So he would learn about their customs. He'd learn about what they did believe in. He'd show respect for what they believed in, and he would gently bring them into a Christian teaching. So that was his way. He realized that there were dangers, but he always tried to make friends with the people that he wanted to convert.
That's so interesting. And he didn't go by himself, did he? Did he have other people with him? Did he have military people with him? How did he prepare?
He didn't have military people with him, but he did have friends, and he made friends with people who kind of had the same approach that he did. I should say that he was an extremely well-educated man to begin with. So the two things that he studied were astronomy and math. And when he was at the Jesuit College in Rome, before he ever left, he made a core group of friends who were also young men who wanted to be missionaries, and he made contact with some of the smartest and most advanced scientists of the day. So when he went to China, he brought with him a mechanical clock that he had made, he brought a globe, he brought maps, he brought little Venetian glass, he brought objects with him that attracted people. Wherever he went in China, he had a custom of laying out on the front porch or in front of the house these objects, which would be like a magnet for the people in the village. They'd come, and then he would engage them in conversation. He learned Mandarin as soon as he could, and one of the problems that he had was that his closest friend, another missionary named Michela Reggiano, or Ruggieri, could not learn Mandarin, and Matteo Ricci did learn Mandarin, and he was a very smart man, very very much an intellect and someone who really relished intellectual challenges. So for him to learn Mandarin was a fun challenge for him, and he learned it, and that helped him obviously in all his work.
That's amazing. So essentially, he was a traveling or a moving museum.
Yes,
of Western art. That's interesting.
Yes,
very cool. And he made the clock.
He made the clock. They called it a mechanical clock. And it came in handy. I'll tell you in a little bit how it came in handy.
Okay. Well, then let me ask you, because you mentioned his education in Rome. So let's talk a bit about how his childhood influenced his work, his family, his education. How did that influence and move him into this position in life?
Well, his family was against him becoming a Jesuit, but they were all for education. His father was a pharmacist in this little town called Macerata, and wanted him to be a pharmacist or maybe even something more high level in the professional world, but he did not want him to be a Jesuit. But the only good education you could get in that part of the world was a Jesuit education. So he sent his son off to Jesuit school, and his father's worst dream came true, which was Matteo Ricci was immediately attracted to the other Jesuits and their intellectual vigor and the way they made learning so interesting and fun. So he was attracted to that. Then he met, as I mentioned, Alessandro Valignano, who was his superior, who had such a progressive way of presenting missionary work that he was, you know, he was hooked.
He didn't ever hope to be a scientist or a doctor in that way?
No, he didn't. He never, as soon as he was in the world, I think his most fun time was in Rome with these, in the Jesuit college, with these other young men who were his equals. He made fast friends, lifelong friends there. And when he was in China, what I perceived in the research that I did was that he was a rather melancholy man. And I think he missed that thing in Rome that he had with all the stimulation of the city and all the stimulation of being in the Jesuit college. And he never found that again, obviously.
The camaraderie he was missing.
Exactly.
Oh, that's sad. Mm-hmm. Well, in thinking about these people that he met, what were the relationships in his life that really fueled him forward?
Well, he had an interesting progression. When he moved from Macau further north into China, he decided that the best way he could communicate to people was if he didn't dress like a Jesuit, but perhaps he would dress like a Buddhist. So he and his friend Kelly, they decided they were going to dress as Buddhists. So they dressed as Buddhists, completely confusing the Chinese people. Like, who are these European men dressed up as Buddhists? And they went around, and they felt that that would make them be more attractive to the people that they wanted to convert. But what they realized was that the real influencers in the Chinese societies of the cities that they visited were not the Buddhists, who were fairly low level, but the Confucianists, and they were really the scholars. So it took them a while, but eventually they realized that they had to abandon the Buddhist clothing and dress like Chinese scholars. As soon as they did that, they began to attract more of the higher men of higher parts of society who wanted to engage them in all kinds of intellectual conversation. And they wanted to know, they wanted to hear Matteo Ricci talk about astronomy and geography. They wanted to see his map of the world, which they couldn't believe, because in their maps, China was the center.
Of course.
So he had this interesting progression, and when actually for himself as a man, when he did start to socialize with the scholars, they were his intellectual equals, and he came close to replicating that camaraderie that he had in Rome.
How interesting. So at that time in China, was there more power in the Confucian world or the Buddhist world?
Confucian world. They were the influencers.
Wow.
And just to remind you, he was born 1552, and so by the time he was in China, he was about 30 years old. So this was a long, long time ago, and most of these people had never seen any European man. He was an oddity, and he was used to being an oddity. As the longer he lived there, he just became used to people coming up and pulling at his clothing or shouting at him sometimes. Sometimes they just viewed him as suspicious and strange, and they just yelled at him or threw things at him. And also, like I said, they believed that he was up to no good. So sometimes they attacked the places where he lived. And one time he even got injured. He injured his foot, and that injury stayed with him for the rest of his life.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah.
So very interesting. What do you think he succeeded at best? Was it in actually converting people, or was it in bringing new ideas that weren't necessarily always religiously based?
Exactly right. He was frustrated that in his life he really didn't convert that many people. But his superiors in Rome were very pleased with his work because what he was doing was actually familiarizing the Chinese people with a European look, European customs, European way of speaking, European way of living. And so they feel that he actually did a certain kind of evangelizing that was really successful. What he wanted to do was to reach the more and more influential people in the Chinese society, and he quickly learned that the person he really wanted to get to was the Emperor of China.
That's the ultimate.
The ultimate, exactly. But he learned that Wan Li, this was the Ming Dynasty, Wan Li, the emperor, had an interesting story himself. He started off being fairly effective as an emperor, and then he got hooked on opium and became less and less interested in ruling properly. And so in China at the time, there were eunuchs, and the eunuchs surrounded him and kind of dominated him and protected him and insulated him. So Matteo Ricci realized, with the help of some Chinese friends, that if he was ever going to get to Wan Li, to have a real relationship with him, he would have to work his way around or through or with or bribe the eunuchs.
Who in their own way were like a brotherhood like the Jesuits, really. So he understood their mentality.
They sound pretty evil. they were, you can imagine, they became eunuchs because their families had castrated them as young boys to sell them into servitude, hoping that the family would make some money from that. So they didn't have a good beginning. They were known as like kind of thugs and gangs, and they extorted money from people. They were like a separate police that had more power. This is what I've read.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating. Well, if you were treated that badly in your childhood, who knows what you would turn into. That's another story, how they got connected to be the guardians, if you will, of the emperor.
Yeah, because that's where they were called to work. I mean, that was the best, that was the place where people all wanted to work because that was money. And so the eunuchs, the emperor felt like he could trust eunuchs because the eunuchs were not going to take away his concubines or have anything to do with his concubines. So he considered them trusted servants.
Makes sense. It makes sense. And you're right. Then they're safe around his wives, and all the children born are clearly his children.
That's right.
So the dynasty is the most important thing.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay. And Father Ricci broke through that? How did he get them? Did he bribe them, or did he make friends?
Well, when he tried to get to Peking or Beijing several times, and he was naive, and the first time he went, you know, he was obvious as a stranger, a foreigner, wherever he went. So it was not easy for him to travel incognito. And also, he wasn't for a foreigner to go anywhere, he was supposed to have permission from the local officials, which he didn't know at first and didn't get it. So he didn't get there until the third attempt. And what's really interesting, he brought all these gifts. He brought the mechanical clock. He brought the Venetian glass. He brought all this stuff because he was going to give it to the emperor. And he was waylaid at one point by one of the most ruthless, well-known eunuchs named Ma Tang. And he captured Matteo Ricci, took all the gifts, and put Matteo Ricci and his friends in prison. And at that point, he didn't know what was going to happen. He thought, this is it. You know, my missionary life is over. I'm captured, and I'll never get out. It was interesting. Somehow he got word through a young boy in the community. He got word to an official he had once met at one of these high-level Confucian dinner parties, and that Confucian scholar arranged for the release of Matteo Ricci. But the eunuch insisted on accompanying him all the way to the Forbidden City. So when they got to the Forbidden City, in a funny way, the eunuch helped him because He arrived with Father Ritchie, and so all the other eunuchs of the city realized, okay, he had some connection here. So they allowed his gifts to be brought to the emperor.
Huh.
Now, here's the best part of the story. The gift that the emperor liked the most, of course, was the mechanical clock. He had never seen it before. They took the gifts. That was it. Goodbye. Well, then the clock stopped working because it was a wind clock.
And they didn't know they could wind it.
And they didn't know they could wind it. So they sent an emissary to find Father Ritchie, who was still in Beijing, and said, "You have to come fix the clock." So Father Ritchie knew exactly what was going on, and he went in and he said, "I'm going to teach you eunuchs." I'm sure he didn't use that word. "I'm going to teach you how to fix it so you can always be in good favor with the emperor." And they really liked that he was thinking of them. And so he taught them how to wind it. And so he established a relationship with these eunuchs. And then the emperor started sending him questions through the eunuchs. You know, where do you come from? How did you get here? What do you know about astronomy? Father Ritchie had predicted an eclipse in China. Uh-huh. And that gave him huge status because they believed in a lot of magic and non-scientific ways of understanding the world.
Superstition and stuff, yeah.
Exactly. They were superstitious. So when he predicted an eclipse, they were astounded. So the emperor asked him questions about astronomy, about the sun, the moon, the stars, and everything. And eventually, he was invited to come. So he was very, very excited. This was the dream of his missionary life, was to meet the emperor. And he went into this room with his one friend, and they were told to sit down. And they looked around, and the only other people in the room were artists who immediately started sketching his portrait. And after about an hour, Father Ritchie was invited to leave. And what they soon learned was that the Emperor Wanli never saw anybody but his own eunuchs.
Right.
He never would allow anyone to actually see him.
They can't have a conversation.
They never had a conversation. Never. Ah. They communicated by letter and messages through the eunuchs, and he never actually had a face-to-face meeting with Wanli.
But no one ever did. So he got as far as a person could get.
He absolutely did. And what happened is, ultimately, I mean, it's a really wonderful story, is that what Father Ritchie wanted was to establish a residence in Beijing. He wanted to be able to bring other Jesuits to come to make a flourishing community. And Wanli finally agreed to that. So
wow.
Father Ritchie lived the end of his days in Beijing.
It sounds like you did have a fascinating life. So my question is, what was your favorite find while you were researching him? What was the coolest thing you think you discovered about him?
Well, I was very interested in his melancholy and how he kind of lived with that. You know, it's not something you read about that often, but he was far away from his family. He never got to see his family again. He never got to go back to Italy again. And yet what he did is he basically went native. He absorbed the Chinese culture, and he always, from the time he started dressing as a Confucian scholar, he maintained that dress forever. He was fluent in Mandarin. He did all these translations. He was the first one to translate the Confucian books to Latin and also some geometry books into Mandarin. He followed that approach of leading with kindness and leading with a wish to understand the other culture. He followed that to the nth degree, to the point where he became fully immersed in this new culture. But he really accomplished what he needed to, because then that culture became much more amenable to Jesuits and Europeans in general.
Interesting. What do you think is in your own background that gave you a connection to Father Mateo?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought of that. I think maybe his curiosity about other people. He was pretty open-minded. And remember, there were a lot of priests who really just wanted to live a quiet life and do their prayer routine and meditation and be somewhat removed from society. And he really was interested in doing exactly the opposite. He went out into the world, very far into the world. And I think also he had an acute sense of justice. He saw methods of conversion that were ineffective, that were mostly trying to force people to change, and they basically would change for a very short time and then revert to whatever they really did believe in. So I think he was interested in other cultures. I think he was open-minded, and I think he was curious. One thing I don't share with him is he was way more brave than I was. There's a pretty detailed description of the sea journey from India to China that was rather harrowing. And one thing that happened that is interesting, though, is that a phenomenon apparently sometimes can happen at sea where in the middle of a storm, lightning will be attracted to the masts of a big ship. And they call it St. Elmo's fire.
Okay, of course.
And this happened in the middle of the voyage he took from India to China. And his friend Michele had a vision in the middle of that storm, in the middle of seeing that St. Elmo's fire. He had a vision of the Blessed Virgin Mary and felt that their whole trip was going to be blessed as a result. But that storm was pretty well described, and it sounds absolutely harrowing. And in fact, a lot of the people who traveled by ship, they never knew if they were going to get there. They never knew if they were going to survive these terrible storms. And then when they did get there, another interesting fact is they would send letters to people back in Rome, and they never knew if the letters were going to get there. And when they received the letters back, it was often 2 or 3 years after they'd been written. So when he went to China, he was far, 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 far away from home.
So in a weird way, it sounds like he did less converting than, in essence, they converted him.
In a way, yes. That's absolutely right. You know, it's funny. All the pictures that I've seen of him, he is in the full Confucian dress. I mean, I've never seen him in a traditional Jesuit outfit. So he did actually get converted in a way. He wrote about the similarities between Confucianism and Christianity, and that was pretty radical. And there were people in Rome who didn't appreciate that. They felt like he'd gone too far.
Right. And yet, what a brilliant idea. The whole point of missionary work is meant to bring the world together, mm-hmm. and that's kind of how you do it. Mm-hmm. He's a little bit way too ahead of his time.
That's right.
That's very cool. All right, well, since these are all historical fictions, we try to stick to as much of the facts as possible, but we're always going to have to invent a little bit for the story to move forward. What do you think is the funnest scene you chose to write, the thing you needed to do that was the most enjoyable to create?
Oh, and that's also interesting. I think I enjoyed writing about his friendships with some of the other Jesuits who he really felt like they were his equals. He liked to have intellectual debates. And in fact, the Buddhists and the Confucians did challenge him to actual debates. But he'd been trained as a debater as a Jesuit in Rome. So he was all ready for these debates. And he liked that a lot. So I had to recreate a few of those in the book, and I enjoyed that. Oh, but cool. Also, I read a bit about the gardens of the middle class or the upper class Chinese families, and I wrote a little bit about his discovering a few of those gardens, and I enjoyed that quite a lot, too.
Oh, that's very cool, very cool. So in debate, he's a ringer.
Yes.
And debates are fun to write. And exactly. Then the gardening's beautiful, because that's such a core of the culture of China.
Absolutely.
Oh, cool, cool. And I wonder then if he had any experience at home in Italy. Well, yeah, because Italians are all about
of
gardens
course,
and plants, too, so that's another thing they share.
Yes, exactly. But there was a lot that was really disturbing to learn about in my research, and particularly the poverty and how willing the families were to sell their children, and the cruelty of the eunuchs. The eunuchs were a force to be reckoned with, and they dominated people in a really cruel way. So I had to recreate some of those scenes, too, and I tried to be realistic, and it was unpleasant.
I can imagine, that's for sure. So what do you think in terms of a theme or the themes of his life? What are the themes, the thoughts that ran through?
I think keeping an open mind in all matters scientific. He was really a scientist and a cartographer, so he really studied the stars. When he went on this voyage across the ocean, he talked to the sea captain to find out exactly how he would do it, how he would navigate. So he had an open mind regarding science, and like I said, he was trained by some of the top thinkers of the time in Rome. For instance, Clavius was an astronomer who was, right at that moment, there was really a debate. Is the sun the center of the universe, or is the earth at the center of the universe? And so it's exciting to me that here he was basically a religious man who was who was thinking about really hard scientific questions. So he straddled both, and I find that fascinating, that he was really a scientist, very much a realist, and yet he was a spiritual man through and through.
That makes sense. But also that you found the best educations came from religious institutions, so you had to match those two things. Well, you mentioned very briefly the gentleman who sounds like he was the mentor in his life. So could you give us a little bit more about his big mentor and then who he maybe was a mentor to?
Yes, Alessandro Valignano was someone who taught at the Jesuit College in Rome. And he himself had somewhat of a checkered past, which might have, in my mind, must have made him attractive to these younger guys. He had been a really wild young man and, in fact, had been arrested for slashing the face of a prostitute with a knife. And he was put in jail in Venice for a year all by himself, solitary confinement. And in that year, he had kind of a conversion experience. And when he came out, he followed the path to becoming, first he thought he'd be a lawyer, then he became a Jesuit, and then he became a Jesuit priest. So that was that was his mentor. That was Father Matteo Ricci's mentor. So that man already had a very open, enlightened view of the world, and he understood himself pretty well. He understood the darker parts of his character, which I think made him a stronger man and a leader. And like I said, he had developed this idea of conversion, which was to be kind and not to force people to do things that they didn't believe, which was pretty radical. So when it came to Matteo Ricci mentoring others, there were lots of younger priests that would come after him. I should say younger missionaries who would come after him. And I can't remember any of their names offhand, but he was very inspirational to the people who worked with him.
That's the best thing you can do.
Yes, exactly.
A whole flood of people. So there isn't one name that we focus on.
Not really.
Cool. Okay, well then, my favorite last question is always then, who have been your mentors in life?
Oh, my mentors in life. I had a college professor who was a Japanese artist, and I would say that he was one of my mentors. His name was Ansei Uchima, and he was a very level-headed, very practical, down-to-earth man. But he just did beautiful artwork. And it was very sort of spiritual, very simple, he was a printmaker. I think it was his steady calm combined with his ability to create and be productive creatively that really inspired me.
How wonderful. How wonderful. Painting can inspire the work of writing.
Absolutely.
Of course. Any artist can. Oh, that's beautiful. Yes. Well, that's a lovely moment that we can say thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.